not going to have the last talk of the afternoon. It's also the last talk of this 3-day workshop. It's going to be Rick Kenyon from Yale who's going to speak on independent covers.
Thanks, Greg. I didn't get a mic. Oh, sorry.
Oh, you need a microphone. I know nothing about that.
Is this one working?
Yeah. It turned on.
Is it turned on?
Yeah.
This value.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Thanks for the organizers. I didn't intend to give a talk here, but I guess there was a cancellation and I got shoved into position. So this is the first time I give a talk on this, and it was somewhat short notice preparation.
Stop. We don't really get. Either your mic is off.
Is it not on?
It is on. Put it farther up, maybe. Drop another button.
Maybe the other side.
Okay.
How about that? Is that better?
You have to press a button.
It's on.
It's on. It's a red button that you have to press.
Yeah. It's on, apparently. So I'll try to talk louder. Is that better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Anyway, this is a joint work with Catherine Wolfram, who's at Yale, and Zurich this year. Just to start off, pretty much everything I learned in math, I learned as an undergrad. When I was a grad student at Princeton, they just didn't have grad classes. They had the at that time. So, all my talk is going to be linear algebra and a little bit of Fourier analysis. And if I'm using something you don't know, please raise your hand. It should be accessible to everyone. All right, I'm not going to talk to any experts because there are no experts on this subject. It's a new subject. Well, okay, maybe there's one or two experts. Okay, here. Well, what's the goal, right? There are certain static models, right? Dimer models, Fanucci model, Ising model, which we know, and the reason we know them is because they're somehow free fermionic. There's some, you can use some linear algebra, determinants, Pfaffians, and so on to study them, and there's a interesting history of those of understanding their scaling limits, what happens when the lattice space goes to zero. And many of us in the room know that. And there are some other models for which we know less, but still some non-trivial things about, like percolation and the Feiberg model and so on. But the first three are free fermionic in the sense that you can study them with linear algebra. And so I want to define a new, fairly rich family of other measures, stat-mech models, which are determinantal, and they're going to be in ZD in general. Although most of the pictures you're going to see are two dimensions, and we're just getting started on three dimensions, so I won't go too far into that. And the tools I'm going to use are simply, linear, the very simple tools, linear algebra and some Fourier analysis. You'll see that the Fourier analysis questions we ask are kind of sophisticated. So if anybody is an expert on that, I'd be happy to talk later. Okay, so let me start with the definition. Every talk should start with the definition. I've got a graph. It's a set. You can think of it as a finite set, or if you like, a graph, and a collection of subsets, which I'm going to call tiles, although that they're going to be overlapping things, so maybe it's better to call them like shingles or something else. But let me just call them tiles because that's what we have been calling them. And associated to this is a matrix, a rectangular matrix, where the rows are indexing the vertices or the elements of the set, and the columns are indexing the tiles. And it's just a incidence matrix, so one or zero, depending on whether the vertex is in the tile or not. Okay, so if you like, you can just start with a rectangular matrix. Forget that stuff. And what's an independent covering? It's a covering of the graph or the set with some subset of tiles. And if the graph has, n vertices, it's a covering of size n. So the one tile per vertex, but the union of the satisfies two properties. The union of the tiles is the whole graph. So you have to cover, and it has to be independent. What does independent mean? It means that the corresponding submatrix of the incidence matrix is a full rank. So the basically what I'm doing is I have this matrix. I'm taking a collection of columns of the matrix, which spans the corresponding row space. Does that make sense? Let's just do an example. This is just the submatrix of D whose columns correspond to the tiles in F. So the columns of the matrix are indexed by the tiles. The rows are indexing by the vertices. And I want to pick a collection of tiles such that the corresponding square submatrix has non-zero determinants. Let's see an example.
So do the edges of the graph play any role?
They play no role at the moment. Edges of the graph play no role, but but that adds some geometry, and eventually we'll do some Fourier analysis where the geometry plays a role. Okay, here's a very simple example. My graph is just the unit the interval from 1 to n, okay, 1 through n, and my tiles are just going to be collections of three consecutive integers, so which can be slid anywhere along there, and I'm going to allow the tiles to sort of go past the endpoint, so the first tile just consists of a single vertex. The second tile is the next first two vertices, and the third tile is the first three vertices, and then it slides along. So tiles are all subsets of three consecutive vertices, including the tiles which sort of go overlap the boundary. Okay, so there's I can just index the tiles by the numbers 0, 3, and plus 1 if I think about the location of the center of the tiles. Right? Everybody with me? So that gives my matrix now is in this case there's 7 vertices, I think, and there's 9 possible tiles. So it's a 7 by 9 matrix. And so for example, the first tile only contains the first vertex. And that's what the matrix, and that's the incidence matrix. And now you can ask, what's an independent cover? It's a collection of 7 tiles. In other words, there's 7 vertices, so I need to pick 7 tiles, and then I want the corresponding submatrix, 7 by 7 submatrix, to have non-zero determinants. And you can ask, that's a fun question to work out if you're bored, which maximal minors, which 7 by 7 minors of this matrix have full rank. Anybody want to guess or know the answer? I'll tell you later. Okay, here's another example. This is kind of the even more motivational example, which is called the uniform spanning tree model. G is a bipartite graph. I pick one vertex, V0, called the root vertex, and the set of tiles now are just the edges of the graph, and then I'm going to add one more tile, which is just the single root vertex by itself. Then here's an example for when the graph is a square. You get this 5. In this case, there's 5 possible tiles. There's 4 edges plus the root vertex, so there's 5 columns and there's 4 vertices. That's the matrix. And the theorem, which is in graph theory, it's called the Poincaré lemma, which says that your minor is the minor has full rank if and only if it's a spanning tree. It's an independent cover is the same thing as a set of V minus 1 edges and V naught itself, which make a spanning tree. It's not so hard to prove this lemma. You can prove it on your own. Conversely, any spanning tree is an independent cover. So the set of independent covers is exactly the set of spanning trees. As you can see in this example, there's 4 possible spanning trees of this graph, and each of them has four parts, three edges and 1 root vertex. Make sense? Who knows the Poincaré lemma?
Now I do.
Now you do. Okay. I don't know why. I don't know. Maybe it really was Poincaré, but that's what my graph theory book told me this was called.
Is there any connection to the usual Poincaré lemma, which is that the closed form is exact on the main of that end?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it is. Yeah. Must be. Anyway, as I was making the slides, I was watching this movie Dune with my daughter.
Thank you. Oh.
Okay. Just in case you were asleep, now you can wake up. Okay. There's a
Need to make
natural.
a stop in Hollywood.
Sorry?
I have to give the stock in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's right. There's a natural probability measure on independent coverage. Now we understand what an independent cover is. Sorry, I'm kind of looking over here, but you guys are also in, Yes. Okay, well, some of them are perfect.
Yeah.
There's a natural probability measure where the probability of an independent cover is proportional to that determinant, right? The determinant of the corresponding minor, I called it the upper end before, that's a mistake. Well, okay, anyway, typo. You just take the determinant squared, and then you divide by a normalization constant. The partition function is the determinant of dd star. That's well, there's a nice linear algebra result which says that for a rectangular matrix, the determinant of dd star is the sum of the maximal minors squared. Cauchy-Binet theorem. So this is the probability, natural probability measure to put on a independent cover. And the theorem is that this measure is a determinantal measure, and it has a kernel, well, this complicated combination of D. So D star is just a transpose of D, DD star inverse times D. And if you know about spanning trees, this is a generalization of a theorem of which was originally due to Burton and Pimentel from the 90s, maybe 93, for the spanning tree case. And this theorem is essentially due to either them or some combination of them, and more generalized by, in this paper, of Benjamini, Lyons, Peres, and Schramm, 2001. That's where I learned it. Let me explain what that means. What's a determinantal measure? Maybe we, for physicists, we should call this a free fermionic measure. But in math, it's a determinantal probability measure. What is it? It's just a measure on binary sequences of length n. Probability measure. It's determinantal if you can find a certain matrix, an n by n matrix K, which is called the kernel, such that which has this property that for any subset of indices, the probability that for every index in the set S, the corresponding variable is one, is given by the determinant of the S by S principal minor of that matrix K. So in some sense, all the probabilities that you want to compute for this measure turn out to be determinants of matrices constructed from the kernel K. So that's where these measures are sort of defined by linear algebra. And the example, of course, the standard example is the spanning tree measure. Edges in a uniform spanning tree form a determinantal measure. Right? If you take a graph and you ask, is this edge in and this is that edge in, this is a 2x2 determinant of the kernel that you associate to that graph. Another example is edges in the dimer model for a planar bipartite graph. This is a theorem of myself. Maybe it was known earlier. And there are some continuous examples of determinantal measures as well, where instead of probabilities, you get probability densities as determinants. And one of the ones we'll use in this talk is this example of the Gaussian analytic function. This is due to Yuval Perez and Balint-Birag in 2005. What we do is we take a power series, just a one variable power series complex analytic function, where the coefficients are independent IID standard complex normals. And this is a power series which converges inside the unit disk. And you can ask, where are the zeros of this function? They're random zeros, random locations of zeros. And the that set of zeros, the locations of those zeros, is a point process which is determinantal. And the density is given by the determinants of some operator in this case. And there are lots of other examples of determinantal processes in random matrices, like GUE, CUE, Ginibre ensemble. You've probably heard of those.
Are they Frickel terms?
No, well, never mind. Not in this talk, for sure. Okay, all my determinants are going to be finite here. So here's a nice linear algebra fact, right? I said we're going to use some linear algebra. This is maybe something you didn't learn in your linear algebra class. At least I didn't learn it in mine, but I learned it recently that if you have a k-dimensional subspace of Rn, W is a k-dimensional subspace of Rn, and suppose they have a basis for W1 through WK, then you make this rectangular matrix, K by N matrix, whose rows are the vectors W1 through WK. Then this expression here is the matrix of the orthogonal projection to W. Okay, is it, who knows this result? Who learned this in linear algebra? All the Europeans. No?
The
I don't think so. I double checked, but I could be wrong.
because you want the image to be the, am I okay? Depends what
Right,
the row
right.
is.
The rows of the vectors.
You're correct. You're correct.
Okay, I'm wrong. Okay, so this is the thing which comes out in the kernel for my independent covers, and so the corollary is that the kernel of the independent cover determinant will measure. Right, that matrix which defines the probability measure is in fact the matrix of orthogonal projection to some subspace. Right, remember our matrix is indexed by the set of all tiles, and the subspace is the it, it, I mean the corresponding subspace is for the matrix is the matrix of projection onto the kernel of D, where D is the remember the mapping from the space of tiles to the space of vertices. Oh, okay. So let's see. Yeah. Okay. So what's a comic? A comic is the complement of an ik, an independent cover, right? So it's this. It's the set of tiles which you don't use in your independent cover, right? If you have an independent cover, you have a certain set of tiles. You can take all the tiles which you don't use. That's the complement. That's called a comic, and that's a property of determinantal measures. Is if you exchange the zeros and the ones, then the new measure is also determinantal, but the kernel just becomes the identity minus the original kernel. So the natural determinantal measure on the for comics as the kernel I minus K, where K is this previous kernel. And so it represents orthogonal projection to the perpendicular subspace to kernel D perp. And the nice thing about a comic is that in many cases it's smaller than the original independent cover. So since the size of the comic is the complement, it's the number of tiles minus the number of vertices of the graph. Okay, so then if you only care about the comic, then you can, rather than use the matrix D, you can use the matrix which forms the basis for the kernel of D, and then the probabilities all work out the same. The probability for a particular comic S, maybe I should have called it something besides S, but it doesn't matter, is this same kind of expression. Okay, so now we can go back to our original example just to summarize what I just said. This was our original example. This was our matrix D. This is a 7 by 9 matrix of full rank, so its kernel is only two-dimensional. And the basis for the kernel is just given by I put them in rows here rather than columns. It's just given by these functions such that the sum of any three consecutive entries is zero. And I could choose my basis. Well, there's several ways to make a basis, but just using some complex numbers, cube roots of one. That's a basis, the 2 by n plus 1 matrix. And therefore, my independent cover is going to use 7 tiles, but the complement of that is only going to use 2 tiles. It's two, right, so 2 locations. And you can ask, what's the probability that those 2 locations are at 2 points, x1 and x2? It's just the corresponding minor squared of that matrix B that I wrote on the previous slide, which is just the, what do you call that matrix? It's just a two-way two matrix. You take the determinant, it just comes out to be zero if x1 is congruent to x2 mod 3 and is some constant otherwise. Some constant like, yeah, anyway, whatever the constant is. So if you're interested in which maximal minors of this matrix have full rank, it's exactly those. Well, you have to remove two columns, but the two columns you remove cannot be a multiple of three apart. So if the two columns you remove are a multiple of three apart, then the minor is zero. Otherwise, it'll be some constant, plus or minus some constant. Okay, no big deal. That was just kind of a baby example.
We want to do this in higher dimension, but let me
tell you, just to pique your interest, let's try a slight variant. It's still in one dimension. All right. So this is I'm going to take the same graph that, consisting of endpoints in a row. And now my tile is going to be, I'm going to put some weights in my tile, some integer weights. So the translates of the tile 14641. So it's going to be five vertices, consecutive vertices, but they'll have weights 4, 6, 4, 1. And those go into the matrix here. And so my D matrix looks like this, looks very, very similar to the previous one, just all translates of the 14641. But now the kernel is more interesting. The kernel of this matrix consists of vectors, which are, f of x, where x is a polynomial degree of most three, except for the sign. Like, for example, if I take 1 minus 2, 3, minus 4, 5, and so on, that's in the kernel of this, and so is the same, right? Each row of this matrix is in the kernel, and therefore the kernel consists of all polynomials of degree at most 3, except for this except for the oscillating index minus 1 to the I. So the probability that so now in this case my comic has four tiles. I mean, my independent set has size 5, and the total matrix has size 9 rows. So my independent set has four tiles, and you can imagine this being very long. It's that I can make n here as large as I want, and the comic will still have only four points in it. That's the advantage of doing the comic rather than the independent cover. And the probability that I get that x1, x2, x3, x4 points are, my comic consists of exactly those four points, is proportional to the, so what I do is I take the V matrix and I look at the column, the x1 column, the x2 column, the x3 column, the x4 column, and I take the determinant. But that's exactly a Vandermonde matrix whose determinant is this, Vandermonde squared. I mean, when you square it, the determinant is the Vandermonde squared. So the probability proportional to the difference of the xi's squared, product over all i's and d's.
Oh, it's not a coincidence.
No, that's not a coincidence. What's going on is that I took a tile here whose coefficients were binomial. So it's Fourier transform has multiple roots on the unit circle, and that's what caused this interesting behavior here in the. So it's an interesting determinantal process on four-point subsets of a big interval, but the density is a very familiar, beta equals two density.
Does it get up to bigger numbers at the final unit?
I get more points. If I took a 1, 5, 10, 10, 5, 1, I just get 5 points with the same kind of expression. Any questions so far? Because I'm going to go to a higher dimension now. Yeah.
Can you speak up? I can't really hear. It's not going to say initial time, it's a subset.
Right, the tile was five consecutive vertices, 1, 1, 4, 6, 4, 1. And the
oops, I went back too far.
Yeah, so this dot represents the center of one of my tiles, right? So this dot really represents a tile sitting there in inside the interval from, you know, well, minus one to n plus two or something like that. Was that your question? I really can't hear you.
What's the role of the weights? What's the role of the weights? Yeah.
Well, they change the kernel of the matrix and they change everything, right? I guess in principle, you know, you could use other non-integer weights, but this problem originally came from a different problem where we needed positive integer weights. So basically, if you want, you can ignore this example and then ask for all the weights to be one or zero. It could just be the incidence matrix. Okay, let's go to two dimensions now, and we see some more phenomena that we didn't see before. So here I just took the G is now a subset of Z2, and my tile is just gonna be the L tile. All translates of the L tile, you know, just translates, I'm not allowed to rotate. So the L tile is just the polyomino or the subset 0, 0, 1, 0, 01 in Z2. And so you can see a kind of a picture over here. What this is I took G to be a big square, and I took a random comic, so that I'm not drawing the independent cover, because the independent cover has n squared, almost n squared tiles. In fact, it will have exactly n squared tiles, but the comic, the complement of it only has like two n tiles. And what you see is that the tile mostly, you know, near the boundary. This is a perfect example. The tiles are mostly near the boundary. There's a few in the middle. What did I do for this picture? I just tilted that picture with a linear map. First of all, I took a triangle. Rather than taking the square, I took a triangle and then tilted it so that you can see a little bit of extra symmetry here. If you tilt the L tile, then it looks like a little equilateral triangle. But then I took a comic for that one. So this one has some nice threefold symmetry, which is not evident in that previous picture.
And so what's happening now
in the scaling limit
to this process? It's a determinantal process.
And the scaling limit is that it's looking like the zeros of a Gaussian analytic function. Here's a picture of the actual Gaussian analytic function, right? As I defined before, you take a power series with independent Gaussian entries. You look at its zeros, they look kind of like that. This is an actual simulation of the zeros. And so the theorem of Paris and Bragg show that the zeros are a determinantal process on the unit disk with a certain kernel, which is called the Bergmann kernel. It's a function of CNW, which is on the unit disk, is given by this. But this Bergmann kernel exists on any domain in the complex plane. It's the projection kernel from L2 of the domain to L2 holomorphic functions on the domain. So you take L2 function on the domain, and there's a projection operator to find the closest analytic function on the domain, which is an L2, and this is the kernel of that projection operator, and that's the theorem. The theorem is that you take the L tile here on a domain in U, you take a lattice approximation to it. In epsilon z2, well, I change coordinates a little bit. In the limit, in the scaling limit, in the limit of the scaling, scale goes to zero, the point process for the comic for this L tile converges after that linear map that I discussed to the zeros of the Gaussian analytic function on the domain U. So, you know, if I as the mesh size goes to zero, the scaling limit of this comic process it'll still be on the triangle, but if I apply the Riemann map to the circle, I will get the same process in law as the zeros of the Gaussian analytic function. The nice thing about this Gaussian analytic function process is that it's conformally invariant. If you apply a conformal change of domain, it goes to the Gaussian analytic function on that domain.
Okay. But remind me, how many points are there in that triangle?
Well, it's linear. The number of points is linear in the size of the triangle.
It's linear in the size.
So it's like two, twice the side length. roughly. I've forgotten exactly the amount, but it's a linear number of sites.
Right.
And you know, most of them go to the boundary, but in the scaling limit, you know, they'll sort of accumulate on the boundary, but there'll be still some inside, and the density of them inside is given by this the same as the Gaussian analyze function there. So it's kind of a nice, reasonably simple. Yeah.
What do you mean by after you know?
Well, the linear map, which takes the square grid to the, see, if I did it in the square grid, it wouldn't converge to the Gaussian, the conform, the correct conformal structure is obtained by this coordinate rather than the square grid coordinate. So I have to take the L tile and then tilt it by the, whatever that linear map is. Any more questions about that?
Blow up the square, the triangle to a circle, will like it.
Yeah, that's right. In order to identify this process with this process, I have to use the conformal map from the triangle to the disk. Yeah. Okay, so, well, corollary, the comics for the L tile are conformally invariant because we know what they're, we identified their limits.
There's no choice if they do square parts of the square.
Yeah, well, see the next slide. He asked, what happens if I change my tile from an L to some other tile? I mean, that's pretty much the next obvious question. Sorry, okay. Sorry, let me tell you about how the proof goes and then I'll get to your question, Martin. All right. This proof is kind of, is not so easy, right? Just because I fit it on one slide doesn't mean the whole proof is there. This is a very rough idea of the proof. Well, there's two things you need to do, right? The remember that the kernel of the determinative process is projection on this particular subspace of functions, and that subspace is kernel of D. What does that mean? It means that your function on Z2 is in the kernel of D if when you sum the value at a, I didn't make a slide, but I have a function on, right? There's the lattice, there's two lattices. There's a set of tiles, which is also a Z2 lattice, and there's a set of vertices, which is Z2 lattice. And if I have a function on Z2, it's in the kernel if when I sum it at these three locations, I get zero. Because for each vertex V, I want this tile, the value of this tile, plus the value of that tile, plus the value of that tile to add up to zero. So I'm looking for functions on Z2, which have this property that this value plus this value plus this value equals zero. That's the kernel. At least, you know, and then there's the boundary conditions, which I'm just taking sort of free boundary conditions. I'm allowing the tiles to overlap the boundary. But let's not worry too much about those. So one example of such a function looks like this, right? If I just take omega to the x minus y, where omega is this cube root of 1, right? So omega plus omega, well, 1 plus omega squared plus omega. That's one function. And the lemma is that any function which satisfies that on a large domain will look like this function here times a smooth function, unless any function which stays bound, which you know is bounded in L2, right? If I can define any function in the kernel by just defining the values on a vertical strip and a horizontal strip, and then the value here will be the sum of the previous two, and this value here is the sum of the previous two. But all those functions will sort of blow up exponentially fast unless they are this type. This particular periodic function times a smooth function. So that's something you have to prove. And in addition, once you have this form and you apply the D operator, you see that F has to be actually an analytic function of the, just by Taylor expanding the D of F, you see that F has to be an analytic function of this, the shifted, the tilted coordinate, X minus omega squared Y, the coordinate when you get tilted like that. So that's a little, that requires some for a little bit of Fourier analysis and the uncertainty principle to prove that step. But then you see that after conjugating your function by this oscillating prefactor, this prefactor, then it looks just like a smooth function. And then the projection from this onto this smooth function, it tells you that the when you project on this lattice, the projection is a discrete version of the Bergman kernel, and then you can kind of wave your hands a little bit. Well, at least that's what I'm doing now, and show that it converges to the scaling limit to the actual Bergman kernel, the projection from L2 to the analytic functions. Okay, that's all I want to say about the proof, but there's some there's a lot of details there.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you something. Can you kind of wait while you how you get the problem with epsilon involved?
How I get what?
I have the impression that you have a uniform bound or going to say kernels theory of the norm.
Yes.
Yes, from your node problem.
Yeah, well we have a let's talk afterward. Okay. And that's it's somewhat technical and I want to get to the fun stuff. Okay, so now to Martin's question. What property of the L tile did we use? And can we use that property for other tiles? Right? Well, if we think about the Fourier transform of the L tile has these three vertices, 0, 0, 1, 0, and 0, 1. And if we call Z the Fourier transform of translation to the right and W the Fourier transform of translation up, then the Fourier transform of L tile is just 1 plus Z plus W, just multiplication by 1 plus Z plus W. And this polynomial of two variables, 1 plus Z plus W, has the property that it only has simple zeros on the unit torus. Well, certainly that's true. I mean, if you look for the zeros of this thing on the unit torus, they're just omega, omega squared, and omega squared, omega. And that's the property that leads to this conformal invariance, leads to this Bergman kernel. And basically because of the same story on the previous slide, if you just have simple zeros, then you can multiply by this oscillating factor and find a smooth function. If you just have a pair of simple zeros. So similar results are going to hold for any comic as long as you're when you have only one tile, and that tile has the property that its Fourier transform P has only a single pair of complex conjugate simple zeros on the unit torus. For example, and here's some examples. So some tiles are nice. They lead to conformally invariant processes. In fact, they always lead to linear scales of this Bergman kernel process, Gaussian analytic function. However, there are plenty of other tiles which don't have that property. For example, this one, this tile has multiple simple root pairs. And so what we get is actually a linear superposition of these Bergman kernels, and is not conformally invariant. Or rather, there's two conformally invariant things, but each one is shifted and by a different linear factor. The sort of a superposition of two different shifted and oscillated Bergman kernels. Sorry, that's I should have made a picture here, but I didn't. But then some tiles, like the square, that was Martin's idea, intersect the torus in more than just a fine set of points. And those have weird behavior, which we don't really know how to classify. So for example, this square tile, the Fourier transform is 1 plus Z times 1 plus W. It intersects the unit torus in the union of two curves, Z equals minus 1 and W equals minus 1. Here's a random sample of that. It's still a determinantal process. It's pretty easy to get your computer to spit out a random sample for the triangle, but the sort of covariance function between these tiles is kind of complicated. What I did was I asked, what's the covariance between a tile here and a tile at a different location in the triangle? And you can see that the covariance function has a sort of delta functions along the horizontal and vertical, and it's got this analytic part, and then it's sort of only piecewise analytic. In fact, the square over here is independent of a square over here. The locations, the density of squares here and over here are independent of each other. for mysterious reasons. But I mean, we can prove it, but it has something to do with the fact that these curves are this polynomial factors. So we get kind of weirdish behavior in this setting. Here's another example with also weird behavior of a completely different type. Our tile, we just tweaked the tile just a little bit by adding some weights twos. This is the new polynomial. Now the zero set on the torus is also not a set of points, it's a curve, but a different kind of curve. And you know this. Here, this sample was on a disk again, but apparently the disk is not so important that it's on a disk. The interesting thing is that the covariance functions for tiles here has this kind of conical behavior, kind of like a interesting Minkowski or Lorentzian geometry. If you have a tile here and a tile out here, they're sort of exponentially uncorrelated, but tiles which are causally related have some polynomial correlation. Kind of weird, I don't understand, but this is what you get from the Fourier analysis of this tile. Again, I'm just doing linear algebra, right? It's just, you know, to get this covariance function, I just had to invert a certain matrix, which is based on basically finding the Fourier coefficients of 1 over p.
Here's another polynomial, the plus polynomial.
It's also got a curve, but it's a closed curve in this case. And the covariance function is pretty weird, sort of oscillates in every location, but it's definitely got some long range structure, which you don't really understand.
None of these are sort of conformally invariant. But we do sort of can compute their scaling limit, the scaling limit of the kernel. Well,
at least that we know how to do some Fourier integrals.
But what happens in 3D? Oh, I had a picture for 3D. Well, let me
read the slide first, and then I'll show you a picture. If you have one tile in three dimensions, typically it's not going to intersect the torus in a finite set of points. It'll intersect the torus in a one-dimensional, subvariety, and that's the case where the Fourier analysis is complicated. We don't have any sort of general description of the, because it depends on sort of a case-by-case basis what that curve is. I don't have a good, I'm a baby when it comes to Fourier analysis. I don't understand how to do these integrals yet. So thinking about it, working on it, or looking for an expert. On the other hand, if there's two tile types, then typically you get isolated points just by dimension counting. For example, if I take 1 plus z plus w in the xy, one tile in the xy plane and one sort of a vertical dimer in the z plane, then you get a finite set of points. I think there's only two points here, u equals minus one, and z and w are the q roots of one. Then you get some nice three-dimensional point process, which has this, well, I can't say conformal invariance, but I can at least say sort of stretched rotational invariance. Once you apply the appropriate linear map, you get a rotational invariant point process. And again, going back to what I said before, if you take your graph to be z cubed and you take all the edges of z cubed plus one extra, a large region in z cubed and one extra vertex along with the edges, then you do get the 3D spanning tree as the independent cover model. And we know to what extent that's a sort of big open question. There are questions about the spanning tree for which we know the answer, and there sort of has some rotational invariance of the edge covariance functions, but the other questions, like, you know, what are the branches of the spanning tree look like, those are still open questions. So just because we can prove that certain things are conformally invariant or know the scaling limit of certain observables, there can be other observables for which we don't get information directly from this
procedure. Let me see if I can, let me pull up the other, just to show you that the one, oh, where did it go? Here it is. I made a picture of a, can you see that? This is a 3D point process. And you know, in 3D, you can't really see a whole lot, but this is a 3D process, point process on a cube, which comes from the tile, which is the three-dimensional version of the L tile. And you know, I don't know what you can really tell from this example, but there it is. It's not so hard to make these simulations. These are all exact samples because there is an exact sampling algorithm for determinantal processes. Any questions?
What's the analog of a Bergman kernel?
Sorry, what?
What's the analog of the Bergman kernel?
What's the analog of the Bergman kernel?
Is there?
No, this is not the. This is there's yeah. I don't know what to say about this. I mean, I can write down a formula, but there's no conformal invariance, conformally invariant object in three dimensions. There is no Bergman kernel in three dimensions. So.
Well, you could study solutions of Dirac equation. So the analog of holomorphic function is a solution to Dirac equation. Take the L2 of spinners and project on the ball, project them onto the solutions of Dirac
equation. Yeah. Whether that arises in such a model is not clear to me, but right. So the question is what's the analog of the Bergman kernel in 3D? Is there some Dirac operator, which I don't know. Good question. And that, thank you very much. That's all I had to say.
Are there more questions?
Yeah, Martin.
Video cube. So like most of them do this video code base. But
yeah.
Other three bases, you still have more than like the same model, guys. No, that's it.
This one is kind of a non-isotropic model. Definitely the points are accumulating on three of the faces, but not the other. I mean, it's some sort of a.
You still have the same model points on top of them? Could I get photos of power to land?
Yeah. I think that the density of points inside is some continuous function of the distance. Yeah.
So does it make sense to introduce some parameters in your model, like maybe weights, then study how they how they measure depends on the weights?
Yeah, that's right. I for this talk, I just chose the constant weights, but it's kind of like the spanning tree. You can add conductances to the spanning tree, and then you get slightly different behavior, but the global behavior is roughly the same. That's what I think happens in these models. Basically, you know, the underlying Laplacian, which is dd star, you can add some conductances in there and put parameters. Is that what you're asking?
Well, there's an interesting connection in the space of parameters, which is like a generalization invariant connection, which usually is written in terms of those operators. And one of the examples of that would be the ADHM construction for instant dots, four dimensions.
Okay, so maybe we can talk. If you have some good ideas, this is great. And it's a new subject for us too. So if you have good ideas, please bring them to me. Can we talk afterwards?
Can you come tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow. Okay. Any other questions?
There's one back here. You speak out louder. Louder.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, he's asking, is there a, can we prove that there's a scaling limit in 3D, even if we can't describe it? Yes. Well, no. Okay, I'm 90% sure that I can, but you know, until things are written down, which they are not at the moment, I'm not going to, you know, be definitive about that.
So yeah, it's a good question, but I believe that the linear algebra all works out, and there will be a scaling limit.
If there are no further questions, let's thank Rick for his comic relief. And this concludes this first part of this week's activity.